Well, how can I follow that? Well, first off, let me actually get things going here. A very small window to get things set up, but I'm doing my best, so bear with me. I want to thank you all for being here once again. I am very excited to, for the third time in a row, to be able to wrap up this Pastor's Choice series. And today we will be discussing worship. It actually wasn't my choice. I'm doing my best, guys. Point is, it actually wasn't my choice. It was Doug that wanted me to talk about worship. I was very happy to oblige. And I've been going through kind of a worship course that I've gotten some of this from. It's been a lot of fun to go through that and to learn more. And I'm excited to be able to share some of it with you. So today we have a dummy's guide to worship. Oh, come on. Connor, you might have to do the work for me here. Oh, man. You know, I'm always the one that's like upset at Doug for breaking this, and I'm the one that always has to fix it, but here I am. Oh, man. Well, Connor's going to run the slides for me back there, so he's going to be paying close attention. I'm going to be giving him as good a cues as I can, but right now, I want to start off with something just a little bit different. Believe it or not, humans have been arguing for a very long time. It's kind of like what we do. Some of us argue just to play devil's advocate. Some of us argue to prove others wrong. Some of us argue to try and prove ourselves right. But when it comes down to it, and I'm very guilty of this, we argue a lot. I'm a very stubborn person. I come from a stubborn family. It is what it is. We argue. But there was a time in which we as humans would argue about things, and believe it or not, there was a time in which we could not Google the answer to the things that we argued. Now, I don't speak from experience, but people older than me and wiser than me in some cases tell me that that is the case. You would get a group of friends, go sit down, and without too much time passing, you would be locked in an argument to the death over something entirely inconsequential. So I want to bring that back a little bit today. We're going to argue about some things. You're going to argue with your neighbor, your spouse, your kids about inconsequential things. And I have 5 questions. If you get all 5 right, then I guess, I don't know, you win. I don't know what. Although I guess that's kind of the point of having any argument is just to win, just to have bragging rights, I guess. So first things first, first question, you're going to have about 15 seconds to argue this point, to make your case to the person next to you. So you better be quick. As soon as I give this question here, then we'll be off to the races. First question, what does SMH mean? Better go quick. Younger people might have an advantage on this one. All right. What's the answer? I heard it. What's the answer? Shaking my head. SMH means shaking my head. Who got that right? Raise your hand. A few of you. You know, I shouldn't say this, but I actually had to Google that one. I didn't know. Next one, how many inches are in a mile? Not feet. I know some of you might be quick at math, and you'll be able to get this. Brian's probably one of them. He's some kind of, I don't know what's going on up there, but how many inches are in a mile? All right, the answer is 63,360. Did anybody get that? Ooh, a few people did. That's impressive. Well done. Next question. This is a very, very important question in our political debate. How old is Donald Trump? Don't let the hair fool you. The answer is 72. A few. Next question. Don't let the hair fool you. It's not real. It's a toupee, believe it or not. Next question. Can dogs eat bananas? Somebody's Googled this before. The answer is yes, in moderation. The sugars in a banana will eventually hurt the dog, but in moderation, it is a fine treat. As with most things that we humans ignore in moderation. Why is the sky blue? Last question. All right, before we move on, does anybody have four right? A few of you have four right? Well, the answer, if you had a really, really good science class in high school, the answer is when blue light hits our atmosphere, it's scattered by the nitrogen and oxygen in our atmosphere, whereas other colors pass through it more easily due to the ratio of the wavelength of the color and the diameter of the molecules they are hitting. If you had a...
I got it right!
If you had an okay...
I was homeschooled.
I believe that. She was homeschooled. If you had just a mediocre science class, the answer is Rayleigh's scattering is the name of that process. Even if you didn't remember what the process was, that is the name of it. Well, like I said, this is going to blow your mind, I know. But people have been arguing for a very long time about random things that don't matter, just like we were doing here today. People have been arguing and arguing about inconsequential things. And this goes back to biblical times. I know, right? It's like humans have been human for a very long time. But we're going to pick up in John 4, 19 to 22 in a little ways here. But before Connor puts that on the screen, we're going to give you a... That's all right, Connor. We're exploring this together. Before we go into that, I want to give you a little bit of historical background. This is the passage of Jesus meeting with the woman at the well. I'm sure you've heard it before. Jesus meets this woman, and he has a conversation with her, and she's a Samaritan woman. And he's in this conversation. He's kind of talking to her, and she's feeling a little bit convicted, maybe in some things. And you kind of get the sense from that in this conversation. But there's some context that you have to know before we go here. It's that the Samaritans have been arguing with the Jews about something you would think would be important, I guess. But I'll give you the cases. The Jews thought that the place where you worship was in, this is an easy one. Somebody have the answer? Don't overthink it. The Jerusalem, the temple. That's where you worship. That's where you went. That's where you worshiped. You went to the temple. You encountered God in that place. That's where you made sacrifices. That's where you worship. It just is what it is. The Samaritans, on the other hand, thought something differently. They thought that you worshiped at a place called Mount Gerizim. And at Mount Gerizim, they thought this was a place of historical and spiritual significance, which it was, actually. When the Israelites first came into Canaan, what they would do is they would bless this direction towards Mount Gerizim and then curse this direction towards Mount Ebal, which is just a little short ways away. In fact, Joshua even built an altar to God on Mount Gerizim. In fact, the Samaritans, to kind of enforce this a little bit as well as some of their other practices, they actually rewrote the Bible, and they called it the Samaritan Pentateuch. The Jews were not innocent in all this either. They were not innocent in this argument, because actually there was a time when a group of Jews, they came and they destroyed the temple that the Samaritans had built on Mount Gerizim. This feud had been going on for a very long time. The Jews and Samaritans already did not like each other. Intentions were very high when Jesus was talking to this woman at the well. So that's where we come in to verse 19 right now. "Sir," the woman said, "you must be a prophet. So tell me, why is it that you Jews insist that Jerusalem is the only place of worship while we Samaritans claim it is here at Mount Gerizim, where our ancestors worship?" Jesus replied, "Believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it will no longer matter whether you worship the Father on this mountain or in Jerusalem. See, you Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him, for salvation comes through the Jews." You kind of get the sense that this woman is maybe even a little bit annoyed at Jesus at this point. Why is it that you Jews insist Jerusalem is the only place of worship? Like, she's trying to back him into a corner, hoping he'll say one thing or another that she can kind of discount what he says, so that she doesn't have to like actually take into herself what he says, because she's been feeling convicted and she wants any excuse just not to listen. You kind of get that sense from the way she's talking in this passage, but Jesus gives a typical Jesus answer, not something you'd expect. What he says, basically, is it doesn't matter. It's a meaningless fight. In a little while, it really just won't matter. I like the way that David A. Da Silva puts it in his book. He says, "Both Jerusalem and Mount Gerizim are rejected as places where God is encountered. The longstanding feud between Bethel and Zion is pointless. For only in Jesus do we encounter God, and only Jesus supplies a spirit without which we cannot offer true worship." This woman is asking the wrong question. She's asking, where do we go to encounter God? What is the place where we go to encounter God? And Jesus says, no, you're asking the wrong question. It's not where we go. It's not where we worship. It's how we worship. It's who we worship. We don't encounter God through geography. We encounter God through Jesus. That's your first fill-in there. Hopefully that most of you are aware of this. We don't encounter God through geography. We encounter God through Jesus. We don't come to church as the place where, the only place where we worship. We come to church as a gathering of believers so that we can worship collectively, but it's not the place. It's a place. We don't encounter God because we're here. We encounter God because Jesus is here. So, Jesus continues in verse 23. "But the time is coming, indeed it is here now, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father is looking for those who will worship him in that way, for God is spirit. So those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know the Messiah is coming, the one who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus told her, "I am the Messiah." Jesus says, true worship is in spirit and in truth. Certain, and most of you have heard that before, but those words, kind of, they don't really seem to make a whole lot of sense here, right? Because both spirit and truth, they're nouns, and Jesus is using them as adverbs here. It's my second grade English. I was homeschooled, too. They're used as adverbs here. So how can we worship in spirit and in truth? That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Well, today, we're going to dive into that, and hopefully we can learn something together as we do. But before we really do dive into this, there's something I want to share with you. These words, they have to be explained as separate pieces, because they're two different words, and I'm one person. I can't explain two things at one time. But with that, they have to be understood together. They have to be understood as one piece, as a collective. So, as I'm explaining this, you might hear some things that maybe irk you, rub you the wrong way, make you a little uncomfortable, and that's okay. Don't walk out on me yet, because there's more to the story. So let's hop into it. I think the best way to really understand what it means to worship in spirit and in truth is to use an example that God gives us, of people not doing that thing. Matthew 15, 17 to 9 is a passage that Jesus is talking to the Pharisees in. And he's rebuking them. He says here, "You hypocrites, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, for he wrote, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me.'" They honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. "Their worship is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas as commandments from God." This is a great example of what not to do, especially because we get these two verses, and they're kind of portraying two different ideas. One is more along the lines of spirit, and the other along the lines of truth. And we're going to dive into them both separately here, using these as kind of our litmus test. "So these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." So what does that mean? Well, I think it's pretty clear that the Pharisees, they were saying things, but they were just moving their mouth, and the words coming out were just that. They were just words, nothing behind them. There was no heart in what they were saying. Their hearts were not in line with God. There was no feeling or emotion in what they were saying. And if this is what not to do, I would say that to worship in spirit is to worship with a heartfelt desire and a real enthusiasm. To worship in spirit is to worship with a heartfelt desire and real enthusiasm. This would be a longing to be with God, a desire to meet him in this place. Enthusiasm is, well, it's enthusiasm. It goes right along with that. A wanting to meet him right here, right now, because you're excited to do so. Worship, I like to think, can kind of be understood as like, is this emotive part of worship? That may be one of those things that irks you a little bit, makes you uncomfortable, and that's okay. In fact, that's good that you're on your guard. But let me explain this a little bit. Worship might be understood as the spirit might kind of be understood as the emotive part of worship. I think one of the reasons that irks us is because a lot of people are in one of two camps with this. So we have camp one, and they say that worship and all the emotions that go along with it, every emotion that comes to us in that time, is good and just and true. Then we have people in this camp that say, no, emotion, every emotion that we have in worship, it's not good or just. In fact, emotion is misleading to the idea of worship. So we cut emotion off from worship. And I think both of these camps have something right and something wrong. I would say the answer is more likely somewhere in the middle. The Bible demands feeling in our worship. I've talked about this before a few weeks ago in an Advent piece. But the Bible demands feeling from us. It says multiple times, "Rejoice in the Lord and be glad." We see in the Psalms David pouring his heart out to God in that worship. And if you don't think that there is emotion involved of that pouring, that crying out, then I would say that you're not reading the same book that I am. Clearly, emotion and worship go hand in hand. Worship should evoke things like a fear of God, a brokenness over your sin, a desire for God, gratitude for his mercy, and delight in God himself. These are all things that worship should evoke. But just as feeling should be part of worship, it also must be checked by truth. This is that other part of worship. Again, we read in Matthew 15, "Their worship is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas as commandments from God." I think this is pretty clear. What they're teaching is not of God. the way they worship is not right because it doesn't fall in line with the character of God. To worship in truth, then, would be to worship with an understanding of the character of God. I like to think about it like this. I like to frame it this way. That's a pun. You'll get that in a second. I like to think about it as a bowling analogy. Everyone laughs. Thank you. I like to think about it as a bowling analogy. If spirit is the ball, like I said, I was homeschooled. If spirit is the ball, it's what we put our energy into. It's what we put our emotion into. It's what we actually throw down the lane. If worship is bowling, spirit would be the ball. And I would think of truth like the guardrails. The key, the things that keep us from going into the gutter. I think this is kind of where we fall a lot of times in our worship currently, is we often, especially with recent worship songs, we evoke these emotions. And that's good because, like I said, worship should be emotional. Spirit is part of that, and emotion is part of that spirit. And that's all well and good, but we focus on this God who loves and this God who forgives in the mercy of this God. And those things are all great attributes of our God. But we neglect to realize, we neglect to think about the idea that Jesus was not afraid to point out sin. That's also part of worship. That's also part of understanding who God is. As we grow in understanding of the character of God, we understand that Jesus was not afraid to point out sin. We grow in understanding that whether you like it or not, unfortunately, not everyone ends up in heaven. That is part of the character of our God. As painstaking that may be to think about, it is true, and it should be a part of our worship. As we understand the character of God, as we grow in that understanding, and as we learn more and more about Him and who He is, what that should actually end up doing is feeding right back into this idea of spirit. As we grow in understanding of someone, especially our God, we should be more emotive with them. As we grow in understanding of our God and in understanding of His love and His forgiveness and His justice, that should feed right back into this emotion, and we should get an even greater outpouring of ourselves from that understanding. And with that greater spirit and that heightened spirit, that should reveal more of who God is in that moment, in that worship. And what we get is this beautiful cycle. Worship is cyclical in nature. And we see this at the top of your bulletin here. You have this chart. And I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on this. We've kind of already dealt with this. Truth feeds worship. As we grow in understanding of who God is, that feeds our spirit, that grows us in spirit. And as we grow in spirit, that reveals more about who God is, and we get this wonderful cycle. And then we also add these two things on it. That spirit is stoked by this emotion. And I would say that's where it starts. And then that truth is checked by Scripture. The emotion stokes the spirit, and the truth is checked by Scripture. This is what I mean when I say these are two separate ideas, but they must be understood together, right? So we get this wonderful, beautiful cycle of worship. And it grows inside of us. And as we're in it, we grow, and this loop becomes faster and more beautiful and wonderful. And I really do hope that each of you in here has felt this at some point or multiple points. And I hope that you continue to. If you have been paying attention for the last couple of months, you've probably seen this before. A while ago, I was looking at what does worship mean? How do we define worship? And a lot of it, I didn't really like what I was finding, so I made my own. Worship is to recognize the character of God. That's that truth. To understand who God is and what He stands for, and to check that with Scripture, and to respond to His goodness. That's the emotive part of worship. When we understand who God is, we respond of ourselves. We respond to His goodness. The way we respond is through authentic offering of ourselves. This is what I'll call the Romans 12 clause. Where it says in Romans 12, we offer our bodies as living sacrifices, pleasing and holy. This is your true and proper worship. We offer our bodies as living sacrifices. This is kind of a litmus test to this cycle, because if you're in this cycle, if you're feeling the Spirit, and if truth is being revealed and you're understanding more and more who God is in that moment, and you're not saying, God, here in this moment, right here, right now, I give you everything, all that I am, every piece of me. If that's not what you're thinking in that moment of, God, how good you are, I want you to have all of who I am, because all of who I am is already yours. If that's not on your mind in that moment, I would argue that something is wrong. Because if we're not offering ourselves, it's not worship. If we're in this cycle of truth and Spirit feeding each other, and we're going, God, I love you so much. You are so good. And I give you everything that I am, except for that thing I do on Tuesday nights. I kind of like that. I know you don't, but... Or if we're going, God, I give you everything except my family, or except my house, except my finances, except this, that, or the other thing, except my vices, except my addictions. I give you everything except for that one piece of me. If we're holding back, then it's not true worship. We are not offering ourselves. We are not offering our whole selves. And I will be the first to stand here as your worship director and say, I have done this. I've fallen into this trap the devil lays for us in this cycle. It's a brutal one to get out of. But if we're in it, I would argue that it's not true worship, because it's not offering of our whole selves. It's a hard truth, but it is one. The way we respond to His goodness, to His character, is through authentic offering of ourselves. So there is a word in Scripture used about 71 times in Psalms, not 700, about three other times in Habakkuk. The word is Selah. And the way we get Selah is in these moments, we would have a psalmist pouring out his heart to God. He would end a word or a sentence, and there would be this word there right afterwards, Selah. And then they would continue. And what we believe this word means is along these lines, to praise, to lift up, to pause. Some would argue that it really just means instrumental, quite literally, or piano. But the idea of Selah is that in these moments of worship. We are lifting God up in our silence. That we are acutely aware of how the Spirit is moving in us and through us. We are acutely aware of the way that God is revealing Himself to us, in the way that God is calling ourselves to offer ourselves to Him. This is the real idea of Selah. To allow the Spirit to move in you. So what we're going to do now is something that might make a few of you uncomfortable. A few of you, it may be right up your alley, but a few of you may make a little bit uncomfortable. And to you guys, I say, I don't care. Because we're going to do it anyway, sorry. It's something that we did just a little bit, but I want to make more of a point here. It's something that we did a little bit in an Advent time, but I want to have a time of Selah. So what's going to happen is I'm going to make my way back to the piano, and I'm going to start playing here. And what I want you to do is not listen to the piano and be aware of the notes or the lyrics or the chords. But I want you to pay very close attention to the way that God is moving in you. Something that I've talked about before too is this idea of putting your hands downward to say, God, I'm letting these things go. And turning them up to say, God, what do you give me in this time? How will you reveal yourself to me? God, move in me. So I want to take just a few minutes to do that. I'm going to start playing here, and then I'm going to move into a song. And I don't want you to sing yet, but I want you to be aware of the lyrics and still aware of how God is moving in you. And we'll finish up with a time of